I could never remember all seven of the seven deadly sins of the medieval church. So one day I decided to create for myself a mnemonic device that would help me. I'd like to tell you that I wanted to remember all seven so I could keep from doing any of them. But the truth was that I enjoyed a fantasy that someday on a game show with $100,000 at stake, the MC would announce dramatically, "And now, Mr. Myers, for the grand prize for $100,000, tell us all seven of the seven deadly sins of the Middle Ages." So, sustained by that hope, I juggled them around until I could make the first initial of each one spell a word. Not a word that meant anything, because I wasn't able to do that, but a nonsense word I could remember. The word turned out to be gleeps. G-L-E-A-P-S-C. Sometimes you have to strain if you're going to get through college. Gluttony, lechery, envy, anger, pride, slothfulness, covetousness. And it now belongs to you. No one ever asked me on a game show or even in a living room to name the seven deadly sins, but maybe you'll have better luck. They're all still around, of course, along with a few others. And it was a highly artificial thing to make a list of seven of them. But the medieval church was in love with the number seven. In the Bible, it is the number of perfection. According to one creation story in Genesis, it took God 7 days to make the world. The Hebrew armies marched around the walls of Jericho 7 times. Elisha told the commanding general of the Syrian armies to wash 7 times in the Jordan River. Peter asked once if he should forgive 7 times, thinking that certainly would be the ultimate number. The number 7 shows up 52 times in the book of Revelation alone. So naturally, if there is to be a list, there'll be 7 deadly sins. Each one had a Latin name, and each one had a corresponding animal to illustrate its nature. And even the most illiterate peasant knew what they were, because they were shown in popular paintings, and they were sung about in ballads, and they were talked about from pulpits. Call it, if you like, the church's most wanted list, posted in the hearts of every worshiper. Why do I start with gluttony? No good reason at all, except that in my word gleeps, it comes first, as well as the fact that it is the hardest of all the seven to make relevant in 1987. I want to do a sermon on each one, not because they are a curiosity from the Middle Ages, but because all of them are still alive and well, right here. They wear a different dress, sometimes from what they once wore, but underneath, where you touch the naked skin, they are unchanged. And gluttony is probably the only one that really comes as a surprise, because indulgence in food and drink, even when it's excessive, is a defect we take so lightly that we find it hard to imagine anyone would ever call it a sin. How many sermons do you remember on gluttony? The glutton seems to be in art and literature a congenial sort, with no intention at all of hurting anyone. We welcome him to our table. We make pleasant jokes about his appetite, and he jokes with us and calls for a third helping of dessert. And we remark after he is gone, what a jolly gentleman or lady that was. But the medieval theologians were not simpletons, and unless centuries of Christian thought were mistaken, there are ways in which gluttony is not a joke. Paul was not joking toward the end of his letter to the Philippians when he spoke of people whose God is their belly. Modern versions of that are a little nicer and say things like their God is their own appetite. But for a change, I like the old-fashioned language, blunt as it is, whose God is their belly. If you go poking around among the medieval theologians, you find them describing just how gluttony shows itself. St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, said it consisted of eating too much, too fast, too eagerly, and too expensively, doting on fine and rare foods. He did try to distinguish between the gourmand, whose one thought is for quantity, how much can I eat, and the gourmet, whose one thought is for quality, but he said both were at fault. St. Thomas is so finicky that one wonders if he had a bad stomach. If he had had his way, there would have been precious little left of eating and drinking, except the bare sustaining of physical life. He even felt that to be fussy over the preparation of food, how it is cooked, seasoned, served, in short, to make a cult of appetite is to be a glutton. He goes too far for most of us, I'm sure, but before we write him off too quickly as a party pooper, let's face up to the fact that what he condemned has provided some rather embarrassing moments in our history. Here, for example, is a description of a typical elegant dinner from Trevelyan's English Social History. The first course was part of a large cod, a chine of mutton, some soup, a chicken pie, pudding and roots, etc. Second course, pigeons and asparagus, a fillet of veal with mushrooms and high sauce with it, roasted sweetbreads, hot lobster, apricot tart, and in the middle, a pyramid of syllabubs and jellies. We had a dessert of fruit after dinner, and Madeira, white port, and red to drink as wine. He hardly needs add the last sentence. We were all very cheerful and merry. Now, the purely pagan response to that is to say, bully for them. I wish I'd been at that party. But the seven deadly sins were devised by Christians who undoubtedly felt a little embarrassment at so much devotion to food when not far off from that table others were starving. I doubt that there were very many Anglican bishops serving the privileged class who ever preached from the text, whose God is their belly, and my own face should be red more than once before I have finished. I think it's only fair to remember that Paul may have been talking to some people influenced by wealthy Romans who often made overeating into a fetish. You've read about the vomitarium, that special room where people who gorged themselves could gag themselves until they threw up and could then go back empty for another round of eating. That kind of worship of one of the senses would have struck early Christians as idolatry. No surprise then that there was a Roman senator who had slaves walk backwards in front of him to carry his stomach, or that there was another Roman named Pollio who lived in Naples in the days of Augustus, who used to feed an occasional human fish, I'm sorry, a slave, a human slave, a human being, to his fish because he thought a diet of human flesh improved the flavor of his fish when he ate them. But even to mention those grotesque devotions to the stomach is to risk losing the point of the sermon, because those are largely things of the past. For the most part, we are not the insatiable eaters and guzzlers our ancestors were when they could be. On the contrary, most of us are weight conscious, preoccupied with diets to keep slim. But gluttony, even in its gross forms, has not disappeared entirely. There are still people who live to eat, who stuff themselves with food and drink, even when they know that the calories are deadly for them. I am forever reading from doctors that overeating causes more health problems than any other single disease, habit in this country. But I would falsify the sermon again if I left the impression that gluttony is simply a matter of stuffing oneself with food. Some watch what they eat, but pay no attention to discipline in what or how they drink. Christians are not required to be teetotalers, but if their profession has any meaning at all, it does require that they are to be temperate, that they not drink beyond what is good for their health, and perhaps just as importantly, beyond what is good for their manners. But this is too easy. Everybody agrees we shouldn't eat too much, drink too much, smoke too much, turn any of our appetites into a god. So let's make the sermon a little more relevant and pass on to a more respectable form of gluttony. The desire, the overwhelming appetite for things, for goods, for luxuries we hardly need except to minister to our sense of importance and self-esteem. It is a simple fact that modern advertising encourages this form of gluttony. We are stimulated by an endless barrage of attractive pleas to buy this, buy now, buy and be happy, buy because it's our patriotic duty to buy, because if we don't buy, our beloved country will go down the drain with the gross national product trailing feebly along behind it. Doesn't it seem strange now that Herbert Hoover teased us once with the prospect of a day when there would be 2 chickens in every pot? how modest that ambition seems today. The Douglas Fir Plywood Association says every family must have 2 homes. Detroit says every family needs 2 cars, more likely 3. A Revlon spokesman admits, we have carefully taught women to match their nail polish to their moods and to special occasions so they will buy more of it. Is there any point at which any of this touches sheer extravagance and becomes anti-Christian? Or have we made Christianity so flaccid and so subservient to a consumer society that no judgment punctures us anymore? Are we sometimes wasteful and overindulgent, or is that just an image dreamed up by envious foreigners who are jealous of what we have? This is not a call for asceticism. Christianity is not an ascetic religion. Every man, the Bible says, should eat and drink and enjoy the fruit of his labor. It is a gift of God. Gandhi went far beyond Christ, it seems to me, when he said, I eat to live, to serve, and also, if it so happens, to enjoy. But I do not eat for the sake of enjoyment. Well, it seems to me that Christ must have. He came, we are told, eating and drinking. And his enemies felt that they dared to call him a glutton and a tippler. He liked dinner parties, and wedding feasts. But he knew something that let him live that way without harm, and I think we know what it was. For him, the body was always the junior partner in the business of life. Mind and spirit had priority. What does it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lose his finer self? So we end up with a balancing act between enjoyment and excess. But even in a nice, respectable church like this one, we probably should be reminded once in a while that there is such a thing as excess. That thing the folks of a few centuries ago called gluttony. Dante tried to describe it in his Divine Comedy. He put the gluttons in the 3rd circle of hell with a storm of stinking snow and freezing rain falling around them to make a vile slush under their feet. He made the place into a huge garbage dump. And in that foul, icy paste lay his swollen gluttons. His meaning is clear enough. In life, these people made no higher use of the gifts of God than to wallow in food and drink, producers of garbage. It is a hideous picture, but that is Dante's point. He's saying that if you saw inside the person of uncontrolled appetite, that is what you would see. He, she, is not really as warm-hearted and convivial as it would appear. In fact, cut off in those compulsive appetites from everyone else and in a world of coldness, thinking only of herself. Seen that way, perhaps the forms of gluttony really do deserve a place in the list of seven deadly sins. Next week, a second one very few of us have managed to avoid. Have a nice lunch. And please come back.